said nothing. He only went on looking at Arnie in that fixed, stony, unsettling way. Arnie had never been looked at in that way by anyone in his life, but he recognized the gaze. He supposed anyone would. It was a look of strong, frank suspicion. It scared him. A few months ago, even a few weeks ago, that was probably all it would have done, but now it made him furious as well.
"You're really reaching. Just what the hell have you got against me anyway, Mr. Junkins? Why are you on my ass?"
Junkins laughed and walked around in a large half-circle. The place was entirely empty except for the two of them out here and Will in his office, finishing his hoagie and licking olive oil off his hands and still watching them closely. "What have I got against you?" he said. "That is first-degree murder, Sandy, you Arnie. Does that grab you with any force?" Arnie grew very still. "Don't worry," Junkins said, still walking. "No big, tough cop scene. No menacing threats about going downtown. Except in this case, downtown would be Harrisburg. No Miranda card. Everything is still fine for our hero, Arnold Cunningham."
"I don't understand any of what you're... You understand plenty!" Junkins roared at him.
He had stopped next to a giant yellow hulk of a truck, another of Johnny Pomberton's dumpsters in the making. He stared at Arnie.
"Three of the kids who beat on your car are dead. Autumn red paint samples were taken at both crime scenes, leading us to believe that the vehicle the perpetrator used in both cases was at least in part autumn red. And gee whiz, it just turns out that the car those kids trashed is mostly autumn red. And you stand there and you push your glasses up on your nose and you tell me you don't understand what I'm talking about?
I was in Philadelphia when it happened," Arnie said, quietly. "Don't you get that? Don't you get that at all?"
"Kiddo," Junkins said, flipping his cigarette away, "that's the worst part of it. That's the part that really stinks.
I wish you'd get out of here or put me under arrest or something, because I'm supposed to punch in and do some work."
"For now," Junkins said, "talk is all I got. The first time, when Welch got killed, you were supposed to be home in bed."
"Pretty thin, I know," Arnie said. "Believe me, if I'd known this shit was going to come down on my head, I would have hired a sick friend to sit up with me."
"I don't know, that was good," Junkins said. "Your mother and father had no cause to doubt your tale. I could tell that from speaking to them. And alibis, the true ones, usually have more holes than a Salvation Army suit. It's when they start to look like suits of armor that I get nervous."
"Holy jumping Jesus!" Arnie almost screamed. "It was a fucking chess meet! I've been in the chess club for 4 years now!"
"Until today," Junkins said, and Arnie grew still again. Junkins nodded. "Oh yeah, I talked to the club advisor, Herbert Slauson. He says that the first 3 years you never missed a meeting. Even came to a couple with a low-grade case of the flu. You were his star player. Then this year, you were spotty right from the start."
"I had my car to work on, and I got a girl."
"He said you missed the first three tourneys, and he was pretty surprised when your name turned up on the trip sheet for the Northern States meet. He thought you'd lost all your interest in the club."
"I told you."
"Yes, you did. Too busy. Cars and girls. Just what makes most kids too busy. But you regained your interest long enough to go to Philly, and then you dropped out. That strikes me as very odd."
"I can't see anything funny about it," Arnie said,
but his voice seemed distant, almost lost in the surf roar of blood in his ears.
"Bullshit.
It looks as if you knew it was coming down and set yourself up with an airtight alibi." The roar in his head had even assumed the steady, wave-like beats of surf, each beat accompanied by a dull thrust of pain. He was getting a headache. Why wouldn't this monstrous man with his prying brown eyes just go away? None of it was true, none of it. He hadn't set anything up, not an alibi, not anything. He had been as surprised as anyone else when he read in the paper what had happened. Of course he had been. There was nothing strange going on, unless it was this lunatic's paranoia, and...
How did you hurt your back, anyway, Arnie? And by the way, do you see anything green? Do you see...
He closed his eyes, and for a moment the world seemed to lurch out of its orbit, and he saw that green, grinning, rotting face floating before him, saying,
Start her up. Get the heater going and let's motivate. And while we're at it, let's get the shitters that wrecked our car. Let's grease the little cocksuckers, kid. What do you say? Let's hit them so fucking hard the corpse cutter down at the city hospital will have to pull the paint chips out of their carcasses with pliers. What do you say? Find some doo-wop music on the radio and let's cruise. Let's...
He groped back behind him, touched Christine, her hard, cool, reassuring surface, and things dropped back into place again. He opened his eyes. There's only one other thing, really, Junkins said, and it's very subjective. Nothing you could put on a report. You're different this time, Arnie. Harder, somehow. It's almost as if you put on 20 years. Arnie laughed, and was relieved to hear it sounded quite natural.
Mr. Junkins, you've got a screw loose.
Junkins didn't join him in his laughter.
Uh-huh. I know it.
The whole thing is screwy. Screwier than anything I've investigated in the 10 years I've been a detective. Last time, I felt like I could reach you, Arnie. I felt you were, I don't know, lost, unhappy, groping around, trying to get out. Now I don't feel that at all. I almost feel like I'm talking to a different person. Not a very nice one.
I'm done talking to you,
Arnie said abruptly, and began walking toward the office. I want to know what happened, Junkins called after him. And I'm going to find out. Believe me.
Do me a favor and stay away from here, Arnie said. You're crazy.
He let himself into the office, closed the door behind him, and noticed his hands weren't shaking at all. The room was stuffy with the smells of cigar and olive oil and garlic. He crossed in front of Will without speaking, took his time card out of the rack, and punched in. Kthud. Then he looked through the glass window and saw Junkins standing there, looking at Christine. Will said nothing. Arnie could hear the noisy engine of the big man's respiration. A couple of minutes later, Junkins left.
Cop,
Will said, and ripped out a long belch. It sounded like a chainsaw.
Yeah. Repperton?
Yeah. He thinks I had something to do with it.
Even though you were in Philly?
Arnie shook his head.
He doesn't even seem to care about that.
He's a smart cop, then, Will thought. He knows the facts are wrong, and his intuition tells him there's something even wronger than that. So he's gotten further with it than most cops ever would. But he could spend 1,000,000 years and not get all the way to the truth. He thought of the empty car, driving itself into stall 20 like some weird wind-up toy. The empty ignition slot turning over to start, the engine revving once like a warning snarl, and then falling off. And thinking of these things, Will did not trust himself to look Arnie in the face, even though his own experience in routine deceit was nearly lifelong.
I don't want to send you to Albany if the cops are watching you.
I don't care if you'd send me to Albany or not, but you don't have to worry about the heat. He's the only cop I've seen, and he's crazy. He's not interested in anything but two cases of hit and run.
Now Will's eyes did meet Arnie's. Arnie's gray and distant. Will's a faded no color. The cornea's a dim yellow. They were the eyes of an ancient tomcat who has seen 1,000 mice turned inside out.
He's interested in you, he said. I'd better send Jimmy.
You like the way Jimmy drives, do you?
Will looked at Arnie for a moment and then sighed.
Okay, he said. But if you see that cop, you back off. And if you get caught holding a bag, Cunningham, it's your bag. Do you understand that?
Yes, Arnie said. Do you want me to do some work tonight or what?
There's a 77 Buick in 49. Pull the starter motor, check the solenoid. If it seems okay, pull that too.
Arnie nodded and left. Will's thoughtful eyes drifted from his retreating back to Christine. He had no business sending him to Albany this weekend, and he knew it. The kid knew it, too. But he was going to push ahead anyway. He had said he'd go, and he was now going to, by God, do it. and if anything happened, the kid would stand up. Will was sure of it. There was a time when he surely wouldn't have done. But that time was past now. He had heard it all on the intercom. Junkins had been right. The kid was harder now. Will began to look at the kid's 58 again. Arnie would be taking Will's Chrysler to New York. While he was gone, Will would watch Christine. He would watch Christine and see what happened. Chapter 40. Arnie in Trouble. Rudolph Junkins and Rick Mercer of the Pennsylvania State Police Detective Division sat drinking coffee the following afternoon in a glum little office with paint peeling from the walls. Outside, a depressing mixture of snow and sleet was falling. "I'm pretty sure this is going to be the weekend," Junkins said. "That Chrysler has rolled every 4 or 5 weeks for the last 8 months." "Just understand that busting Darnell and whatever bee you've got in your bonnet about that kid are two different things." "They're both the same thing to me," Junkins replied. "The kid knows something. If I get him rattled, I may find out what it is." "You think he had an accomplice? Someone who used his car and killed those kids while he was at the chess tourney?" Junkins shook his head. "No, goddammit. The kid has got exactly one good friend and he's in the hospital. I don't know what I think. Except that the car was involved, and he was involved too." Junkins put his styrofoam coffee cup down and pointed at the man on the other side of the desk. "Once we get that place closed down, I want a six-pack of lab technicians to go over it from stem to stern, inside and out. I want it up on a lift. I want it checked for dents, bumps, repaint, and for blood. That's what I really want, Rick. Just one drop of blood." "You don't like that kid, do you?" Rick asked. Junkins uttered a bewildered little laugh. "You know, the first time I kind of did. I liked him, and I felt sorry for him. I felt like maybe he was covering for somebody else who had something on him. But this time, I didn't like him at all." He considered. "And I didn't like that car, either. The way he kept touching it every time I had him on the ropes. It was spooky." Rick said, "As long as you remember that Darnell is the guy I've got to bust. No one in Harrisburg has the slightest interest in your kid." "I'll remember," Junkins said. He picked up his coffee again and looked at Rick grimly. "Because he's a means to the end. I'm going to nail the person who killed those kids if it's the last thing I ever do." "It may not even go down this weekend," Rick said. But it did. Two plainclothes cops from Pennsylvania's state felony squad sat in the cab of a 4-year-old Datsun pickup on the morning of Saturday, December 16th, watching as Will Darnell's black Chrysler rolled out of the big door and into the street. A light drizzle was falling. It was not quite cold enough to be sleet. It was one of those misty days when it is impossible to tell where the lowering clouds end and the actual mist begins. The Chrysler was quite properly showing its parking lights. Arnie Cunningham was a safe driver. One of the plainclothesmen lifted a walkie-talkie to his mouth and spoke into it. "He just came out in Darnell's car. You guys stay on your toes." They followed the Chrysler to I-76. When they saw Arnie get on the eastbound ramp with its Harrisburg sign, they turned up the westbound ramp toward Ohio and reported. They would get off I-76 one exit down the line and return to their original position near Darnell's garage. "Okay," Junkins' voice came back. "Let's make an omelet." 20 minutes later, as Arnie was cruising east at a sedate and legal 50, three cops, with all the right paperwork in hand, knocked on the door of William Upshaw, who lived in the very much upscale suburb of Sewickley. Upshaw answered the door in his bathrobe. From behind him came the cartoon squawks of Saturday morning TV.
"Who is it, honey?"
his wife called from the kitchen. Upshaw looked at the papers, which were court orders, and felt that he might faint. One ordered that all of Upshaw's tax records relating to Will Darnell, an individual, and Will Darnell, a corporation, be impounded. These papers bore the signature of the Pennsylvania Attorney General and a Superior Court judge.
"Who is it, hon?"
his wife asked again, and one of his kids came to look, all big eyes. Upshaw tried to speak and could raise only a dusty croak. It had come. He had dreamed about it, And it had finally come. The house in Sewickley had not protected him from it. The woman he kept at a safe distance in King of Prussia had not protected him from it. It was here. He read it in the smooth faces of these cops, in their off-the-rack Anderson Little suits. Worst of all, one of them was federal. Alcohol, tobacco, and firearms. He produced a second ID, proclaiming him an agent of something called the Federal Drug Control Task Force. "Our information is that you keep an office in your home," the federal cop said. He looked, what, 26, 30? Had he ever had to worry about what you were going to do when you had three kids and a wife who liked nice things maybe a little too much? Bill Upshaw didn't think so. When you had those things to think about, your face didn't stay that smooth. Your face only stayed that smooth when you could indulge in the luxury of grand thoughts, law and order, right and wrong, good guys and bad guys. He opened his mouth to answer the federal cop's question and produced only another dusty croak. "Is this information correct?" the federal cop asked patiently. "Yes," Bill Upshaw croaked. "And another office at 100 Frankstown Road in Monroeville." "Yes."
"Hun, who is it?"
Amber asked, and came into the hallway. She saw the three men standing on the stoop and pulled the neck of her housecoat closed. The cartoons blared. Upshaw thought suddenly, almost with relief, "It's the end of everything." The kid who had come out to see who had come to visit so early on a Saturday morning suddenly burst into tears and fled for the safety of the Super Friends on Channel 4. When Rudy Junkins received the news that Upshaw had been served and that all the papers pertaining to Darnell, both at Upshaw's Sewickley home and his Monroeville office, had been impounded, he led half a dozen state cops in what he supposed would have been called a raid in the old days. Even during the holiday season, the garage was moderately busy on Saturday, although it was by no means the bustling place it became on summer weekends. And when Junkins raised a battery-powered loudhailer to his lips and began to use it, perhaps two dozen heads whipped around. They would have conversation enough out of this to last them into the new year. "This is the Pennsylvania State Police," Junkins cried into the loudhailer. The words echoed and bounced. He found, even at this instant, that his eyes were drawn to the white-over-red Plymouth sitting empty in stall 20. He had handled half a dozen murder weapons in his time, sometimes at the scene, more frequently in the witness box, but just looking at that car made him feel cold. Gitney, the IRS man who had come along for this particular sleigh ride, was frowning at him to go on. "None of you know what this is about. None of you." But he raised the loudhailer to his lips again. "This place of business is closed. I repeat, this place of business is closed. You may take your vehicles if they are in running order. If not, please leave quickly and quietly. This place is closed." The loudhailer made an amplified click as he turned it off. He looked toward the office and saw that Will Darnell was talking on the telephone, an unlit cigar jammed in his face. Jimmy Sykes was standing by the Coke machine, his simple face a picture of confused dismay. He didn't look much different from Bill Upshaw's kid at the moment before he burst into tears. "Do you understand your rights as I have read them to you?" The cop in charge was Rick Mercer. Behind them, the garage was empty except for four uniformed cops who were doing paperwork on the cars which had been impounded when the garage was closed.
"Yeah,"
Will said. His face was composed. The only sign of his upset was his deepening wheeze, the fast rise and fall of his big chest under his open-throated white shirt, the way he held his aspirator constantly in one hand.
"Do you have anything to say to us at this time?" Mercer asked. "Not until my lawyer gets here."
"Your lawyer can meet us in Harrisburg," Junkins said. Will glanced at Junkins contemptuously and said nothing. Outside, more uniformed police had finished affixing seals to every door and window of the garage except for the small side door. Until the state of impound ceased, all traffic would use that door.
"This is the craziest thing I ever heard of,"
Will Darnell said at last.
"It'll get crazier," Mercer said, smiling sincerely. "You're going away for a very long time, Will. Maybe someday they'll put you in charge of the prison motor pool."
"I know you," Will said, looking at him. "Your name is Mercer. I knew your father well.
He was the crookedest cop that ever came out of Kings County.
The blood fell out of Rick Mercer's face and he raised his hand.
Stop it, Rick, Junkins said. Sure, Will said. You guys have your fun. Make your jokes about the prison motor pool. I'll be back here doing business in 2 weeks, and if you don't know it, you're even stupider than you look.
He glanced around at them, his eyes intelligent, sardonic, and trapped. Abruptly, he raised his aspirator to his mouth and breathed in deeply.
Get this bag of shit out of here, Mercer said.
He was still white.
You all right?
Junkins asked. They were sitting in an unmarked state Ford half an hour later. The sun had decided to come out and shone blindingly on melting snow and wet streets. Darnell's garage sat silent. Darnell's records and Cunningham's street rod Plymouth were safely penned up inside.
That crack he made about my father, Mercer said heavily. My father shot himself, Rudy. Blew his head off. And I always thought... In college, I read...
He shrugged.
Lots of cops eat the gun. Melvin Purvis did it, you know? He was the man who got Dillinger. But you wonder.
Mercer lit a cigarette and drew smoke downwards in a long, shuddery breath.
He didn't know anything, Junkins said. The fuck he didn't, Mercer said.
He unrolled his window and threw the cigarette out. He unclipped the mic under the dash.
Home, this is Mobile 2.
10-4, Mobile 2.
What's happening with our carrier pigeon?
He's on Interstate 84, coming up on Port Jervis.
Port Jervis was the crossover point between Pennsylvania and New York.
New York is already?
Affirmative.
You tell them again that I want him northeast of Middletown before they grab him, and his toll ticket taken in evidence.
10-4.
Mercer put the mic back and smiled thinly.
Once he crosses into New York, there's not a question in the world about it being federal. But we've still got first dibs. Isn't that beautiful?
Junkins didn't answer. There was nothing beautiful about it. From Darnell with his aspirator to Mercer's father eating his gun, there was nothing beautiful about it. Junkins was filled with a spooky feeling of inevitability, a feeling that the ugly things were not ending but only just beginning to happen. He felt halfway through a dark story that might prove too terrible to finish, except he had to finish it now, didn't he? Yes. The terrible feeling, the terrible image, persisted. That the first time he had talked to Arnie Cunningham, he had been talking to a drowning man. And the second time he had talked to him, the drowning had happened. And he was talking to a corpse. The cloud cover over western New York was breaking, and Arnie's spirits began to rise. It always felt good to get away from Libertyville, away from everything. Not even the knowledge that he had contraband in the trunk could quench that feeling of lift. And at least it wasn't dope this time. Far in the back of his mind, hardly even acknowledged, but there, was the idle speculation about how things would be different, and how his life would change if he just dumped the cigarettes and kept on going, if he just left the entire depressing mess behind. But of course, he wouldn't. Leaving Christine after he had put so much into her was, of course, impossible. He turned up the radio and hummed along with something current. The sun, weakened by December but still trying to be bold, broke cover entirely, and Arnie grinned. He was still grinning when the New York State police car pulled up beside him in the passing lane and paced him. The loudspeaker on top began to chant, "This is for the Chrysler! Pull over, Chrysler, pull over!" Arnie looked over, the grin fading from his lips. He stared into a pair of black sunglasses. Cop glasses. The terror that seized him was deeper than he would have believed any emotion could be, and it wasn't for himself. His mouth went totally dry. His mind went into a blurring overdrive. He saw himself tramping the gas pedal and running for it, and perhaps he would have done it if he had been driving Christine. But he wasn't. He saw Will Darnell telling him that if he got caught holding a bag, it was his bag. Most of all, he saw Junkins, Junkins with his sharp brown eyes, and knew this was Junkins' doing. He wished Rudolph Junkins was dead.
Pull over, Chrysler. I'm not talking to hear my own voice. Pull over right now.
can't say anything, Arnie thought incoherently as he veered over into the breakdown lane. His balls were crawling, his stomach churning madly. He could see his own eyes in the rear view, wall-eyed with fear behind his glasses. Not for him, though. Not for him. Christine. He was afraid for Christine. What they might do to Christine. His panic-stricken mind spun up a kaleidoscope of jumbled images, college application forms with the words "rejected, convicted felon" stamped across them, prison bars, blued steel, a judge bending down from a high bench, his face white and accusing, big bull queers in a prison yard looking for fresh meat, Christine riding the conveyor into the car crusher in the junkyard behind the garage, and then, as he stopped the Chrysler and put it in park, the state police car pulling in behind him, and another, appearing like magic, pulling in ahead of him, a thought came from nowhere, full of cold comfort. Christine can take care of herself. Another thought came as the cops got out and came toward him, one holding a search warrant in his hand. It also seemed to come from nowhere, but it reverberated in Roland D. LeBay's raspy, old man's tones.
"And she'll take care of you, boy. All you gotta do is go on believing in her, and she'll take care of you."
Arnie opened the car door and got out a moment before one of the cops could open it.
"Arnold Richard Cunningham?" one of the cops asked.
"Yes, indeed," Arnie said calmly. "Was I speeding?"
"No, son," one of the others said, "but you are in a world of hurt all the same."
The first cop stepped forward as formally as a career army officer.
"I have a duly executed document here permitting the search of this 1966 Chrysler Imperial in the name of the people of New York State and of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania and of the United States of America. Further..."
"Well, that just about covers the motherfucking waterfront, doesn't it?"
Arnie said. His back flared dully, and he jammed his hands against it. The cop's eyes widened slightly at the old voice coming out of this kid. But then he went on.
"Further, to seize any contraband found in the course of this search in the name of the people of New York State and of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania and of the United States of America."
"Fine,"
Arnie said. None of it seemed real. Blue lights flashed a confusion. People passing in their cars turned to look, but he found he had no desire to turn from them, to hide his face, and that was something of a relief.
"Give me their keys, kid," one of the cops said.
"Why don't you just get them yourself, you shitter?"
Arnie said.
"You're not helping yourself, kiddo," the cop said. But he looked startled and a little fearful all the same. For a moment, the kid's voice had deepened and roughened, and he had sounded 40 years older and a pretty tough customer, nothing like the skinny kid he saw before him at all.
He leaned in, got the keys, and three of the cops immediately headed for the trunk.
They know, Arnie thought, resigned.
At least, this had nothing to do with Junkins's obsession with Buddy Repperton and Moochie Welch and the others. At least, not directly, he amended cautiously. This smelled like a well-planned and well-coordinated operation against Will's smuggling operations from Libertyville into New York and New England.
"Kid," one of the cops said, "would you like to answer some questions or make a statement? If you think you would, I'll read you the Miranda right now."
"Nah,"
Arnie said calmly.
"I don't have anything to say."
"Things could go a lot easier with you."
"That's coercion,"
Arnie said, smiling a little.
"Watch out or you put a big fat hole in your own case."
The cop flushed.
"If you want to be an asshole, that's your lookout."
The Chrysler trunk was open. They had pulled out the spare tire, the jack, and several boxes of small parts, springs, nuts, bolts, and the like. One of the cops was almost entirely in the trunk, only his blue-gray clad legs stuck out. For a moment, Arnie hoped vaguely that they wouldn't find the undercompartment. Then he dismissed the thought. It was just the childish part of him, the part he now wished burned away, because all that part of him did lately was hurt. They would find it. The quicker they found it, the quicker this nasty roadside scene would end. As if some god had heard his wish and decided to grant it post-haste, the cop in the trunk called triumphantly,
"Cigarettes!"
"All right,"
the cop who had read the warrant said.
"Close it up."
He turned to Arnie and read him the Miranda warning.
"Do you understand your rights as I have read them to you?"
"Yes,"
Arnie said.
"Do you want to make a statement?"
"No."
"Get in the car, son. You're under arrest."
"I'm under arrest," Arnie thought, and almost brayed laughter. The thought was so foolish. This was all a dream, and he would wake up soon, under arrest, being hustled to a state police cruiser, people looking at him. Desperate, childish tears, hot salt welled up in his throat and closed it. His chest hitched once, twice. The cop who had read him his rights touched his shoulder, and Arnie shrugged it off with a kind of desperation. He felt that if he could get deep down inside himself quickly enough, he would be okay. But sympathy might drive him mad.
"Don't touch me!"
"You do it the way you want to do it, son," the cop said, removing his hand. He opened the cruiser's rear door for Arnie and handed him in. "Do you cry in dreams?" Of course you could. Hadn't he read about people waking up from sad dreams with tears on their cheeks? But dream or no dream, he wasn't going to cry. Instead, he would think of Christine. Not of his mother or father, not of Lee or Will Darnell, not of Slauson, all the miserable shitters who had betrayed him. He would think of Christine. Arnie closed his eyes and leaned his pale, gaunt face forward into his hands and did just that. And as always, thinking about Christine made things better. After a while, he was able to straighten up and look out at the passing scenery and think about his position. Michael Cunningham put the telephone back into its cradle slowly, with infinite care, as if to do less might cause it to explode and spray his upstairs study with jagged black hooks of shrapnel. He sat back in the swivel chair behind his desk, on which there sat his IBM correcting Selectric II typewriter, an ashtray with the blue and gold legend Horlicks University barely legible across the dirty bottom, and the manuscript of his third book, a study of the ironclads Monitor and Merrimack. He had been halfway through a page when the telephone rang. Now he flipped the paper release on the right side of the typewriter and pulled the page bonelessly out from under the roller, observing its slight curve clinically. He put it down on top of the manuscript, which was now little more than a jungle of penciled-in corrections. Outside, a cold wind whined around the house. The morning's cloudy warmth had given way to a frigid, clear December evening. The earlier melt had frozen tight, and his son was being held in Albany on charges of what amounted to smuggling. "No, Mr. Cunningham, it is not marijuana. It is cigarettes. 200 cartons of Winston cigarettes with no tax stamps." From downstairs he could hear the whir of Regina's sewing machine. He would have to get up now, go to the door and open it, go down the hall to the stairs, walk down the stairs, walk into the dining room, then into the plant-lined little room that had once been a laundry, but which was now a sewing room, and stand there while Regina looked up at him. She would be wearing her half-glasses for the close work, and say, "Regina, Arnie has been arrested by the New York State Police." Michael attempted to begin this process by getting up from his desk chair, but the chair seemed to sense he was temporarily off guard. It swiveled and rolled backward on its casters at the same moment, and Michael had to clutch the edge of his desk to keep from falling. He slipped heavily back into the chair, heart thudding with painful rapidity in his chest. He was struck suddenly by such a complex wave of despair and sorrow that he groaned aloud and grabbed his forehead, squeezing his temples. The old thoughts swarmed back in, as predictable as summer mosquitoes, and just as maddening. 6 months ago, things had been okay. Now his son was sitting in a jail cell somewhere. What were the watershed moments? How could he, Michael, have changed things? What was the history of it exactly? Where had the sickness started to creep in?
Jesus.
He squeezed harder, listening to the winter whine outside the windows. He and Arnie had put the storms on just last month. That had been a good day, hadn't it? First Arnie holding the ladder and looking up, then him down and Arnie up there, him shouting for Arnie to be careful, the wind in his hair and dead brown leaves blowing over his shoes, their colors gone. Sure, it had been a good day. Even after that beastly car had come, seeming to overshadow everything in their son's life like a fatal disease, there had been some good days. Hadn't there?
"Jesus,"
he said again, in a weak, teary voice that he despised. Unbidden images rose behind his eyes, colleagues looking at him sideways, maybe whispering in the faculty club. Discussions at cocktail parties in which his name bobbed uneasily up and down like a waterlogged body. Arnie wouldn't be 18 for almost 2 months, and he supposed that meant his name wouldn't be printed in the paper, but everyone would still know. Word got around. Suddenly, crazily, he saw Arnie at 4, astride a red trike he and Regina had gotten at a rummage sale. Arnie at 4 had called them Mama's Rubbage Sales. The trike's red paint was flaked with scales of rust. The tires were bald, but Arnie had loved it. He would have taken that trike to bed with him if he could. Michael closed his eyes and saw Arnie riding up and down the sidewalk, wearing his blue corduroy jumper, his hair flopping in his eyes, and then his mind's eye blinked or wavered or did something, and the rusty rubbish sale trike was Christine, her red paint scummed with rust, her windows milky white with age. He gritted his teeth together. Someone looking in might have thought he was smiling crazily. He waited until he had some kind of control, and then he got up and went downstairs to tell Regina what had happened. He would tell her, and she would think of what they were going to do, just as she always had. She would steal the forward motion from him, taking whatever sorry balm that actually doing things had to give, and leave him with only sick sorrow, and the knowledge that now his son was someone else. Chapter 41. The Coming of the Storm. The first of that winter's great northeast storms came to Libertyville on Christmas Eve, beating its way across the upper third of the U.S. on a wide and easily predictable storm track. The day began in bright 30-degree sunshine, but morning DJs were already cheerfully predicting doom and gloom, urging those who had not finished their last-minute shopping to do so by mid-afternoon. Those planning trips to the old homestead for an old-fashioned Christmas were urged to rethink their plans if the trip could not be made in 4 to 6 hours.
"If you don't want to be spending Christmas Day in the breakdown lane of I-76 somewhere between Bedford and Carlisle, I'd leave early or not at all," the FM 104 jock advised his listening audience, a large part of which was too stoned to even consider going anyplace, and then resumed the Christmas block party with Springsteen's version of Santa Claus is Coming to Town. By 11 a.m., when Dennis Gilder finally left Libertyville Community Hospital, as per hospital regulations, he was not allowed on his crutches until he was actually out of the building. Until then, he was pushed along in a wheelchair by Elaine. The sky had begun to scum over with clouds, and there was an eerie fairy ring around the sun. Dennis crossed the parking lot carefully on his crutches, his mother and father bookending him nervously, in spite of the fact that the lot had been scrupulously salted free of even the slightest trace of snow and ice. He paused by the family car, turning his face up slightly into the freshening breeze. Being outside was like a resurrection. He felt he could stand here for hours and not have enough of it. By 1 o'clock that afternoon, the Cunningham family station wagon had reached the outskirts of Ligonier, 90 miles east of Libertyville. The sky had gone a smooth and pregnant slate gray by this time, and the temperature had dropped 6 degrees. It had been Arnie's idea that they not cancel the traditional Christmas Eve visit with Aunt Vicky and Uncle Steve, Regina's sister and her husband. The two families had created a casual, loosely rotating ritual over the years, with Vicky and Steve coming to their house some years, the Cunninghams going over to Ligonier on others. This year's trip had been arranged in early December. It had been canceled after what Regina stubbornly called Arnie's trouble. But at the beginning of last week, Arnie had begun restlessly agitating for the trip. At last, after a long telephone conversation with her sister on Wednesday, Regina gave in to Arnie's wish, mostly because Vicky had seemed calm and understanding, and most of all, not very curious about what had happened. That was important to Regina, more important than she would perhaps ever be able to say. It seemed to her that in the 8 days since Arnie had been arrested in New York, she had had to cope with a seemingly endless flood of rancid curiosity, masquerading as sympathy. Talking to Vicky on the telephone, she had finally broken down and cried. It was the first and only time since Arnie had been arrested in New York that she had allowed herself that bitter luxury. Arnie had been in bed asleep. Michael, who was drinking much too much and passing it off as the spirit of the season,
had gone down to O'Malley's for a beer or two with Paul Strickland, another factory reject in the game of faculty politics. It would probably end up being 6 beers, or 8, or 10. And if she went upstairs to his study later on, she would find him sitting bolt upright behind his desk, looking out into the dark, his eyes dry, but bloodshot. If she tried to speak with him, his conversation would be horribly confused and centered too much in the past. She supposed her husband might be having a very quiet mental breakdown. She would not allow herself the same luxury, for so in her own hurt and angry state she thought it. And every night her mind ticked and whirred with plans and schemes until 3 or 4 o'clock. All these thoughts and schemes were aimed at one end, getting us over this. The only two ways she would allow her mind to approach what had happened were deliberately vague. She thought about Arnie's trouble and getting us over this. But, talking to Vicky on the phone a few days after her son's arrest, Regina's iron control had wavered briefly. She cried on Vicky's shoulder long distance, and Vicky had been calmly comforting, making Regina hate herself for all the cheap shots she had taken at Vicky over the years. Vicky, whose only daughter had dropped out of junior college to get married and become a housewife, whose only son had been content with a vocational technical school. None of that for her son, Regina had thought with a private exultation. Vicky, whose husband sold, of all hilarious things, life insurance. And Vicky, hilariouser and hilariouser, sold Tupperware. But it was Vicky she had been able to cry to. It had been Vicky to whom she had been able to express at least part of her tortured sense of disappointment and terror and hurt. Yes, and the terrible embarrassment of it, of knowing that people were talking and that people who had for years wanted to see her take a fall were now satisfied. It was Vicky. Maybe it had always been Vicky. And Regina decided that if there was to be a Christmas at all for them this miserable year, it would be at Vicky and Steve's ordinary suburban ranch house in the amusingly middle-class suburb of Ligonier, where most people still owned American cars and called a trip to McDonald's eating out. Mike, of course, simply went along with her decision. She would have expected no more and brooked no less. For Regina Cunningham, the 3 days following the news that Arnie was in trouble had been an exercise in pure cold control, a hard lunge for survival. Her survival, the family's survival, Arnie's survival. He might not believe that, but Regina found she hadn't the time to care. Mike's pain had never entered her equations. The thought that they could comfort each other had never even crossed her mind as a speculation. She had calmly put the cover on her sewing machine after Mike came downstairs and gave her the news. She did that, and then she had gone to the phone and had gotten to work. The tears she would later shed while talking to her sister had then been 1,000 years away. She had brushed past Michael as if he were a piece of furniture, and he had trailed uncertainly after her, as he had done all of their married life. She called Tom Sprague, their lawyer, who, hearing that their problem was criminal, hastily referred her to a colleague, Jim Warburg. She called Warburg and got an answering service that would not reveal Warburg's home number. She sat by the phone for a moment, drumming her fingers lightly against her lips, and then called their family lawyer back. Sprague hadn't wanted to give her Warburg's home telephone number, but in the end, he gave in. When Regina finally let him go, Sprague sounded dazed, almost shell-shocked. Regina, in full spate, often caused such a reaction. She called Warburg, who said he absolutely couldn't take the case. Regina had lowered her bulldozer blade again. Warburg ended up not only taking the case, but agreeing to go immediately to Albany, where Arnie was being held, to see what could be done. Warburg, speaking in the weak, amazed voice of a man who has been filled full of Novocaine and then run over by a tractor, protested that he knew a perfectly good man in Albany who could get the lay of the land. Regina was adamant. Warburg went by private plane and reported back 4 hours later. Arnie, he said, was being held on an open charge. He would be extradited to Pennsylvania the following day. Pennsylvania and New York had coordinated the bust along with 3 federal agencies, the Federal Drug Control Task Force, the IRS, and the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. The main target was not Arnie, who was small beans, but Will Darnell. Darnell and whomever Darnell was doing business with. Those guys, Warburg said, with their suspected ties to organized crime and disorganized drug smuggling in the New South, were the big beans. Holding someone on an open charge is illegal, Regina had snapped immediately, drawing on a deep backlog of TV crime show fare. Warburg, not exactly overjoyed to be where he was when he had planned on spending a quiet evening at home reading a book, rejoined crisply,
"I'd be down on my knees thanking God that's what they're doing. They caught him with a trunkload of unstamped cigarettes, and if I push them on it, they'll be more than happy to charge him, Mrs. Cunningham. I advise you and your husband to get over here to Albany, quickly."
"I thought you said he was going to be extradited tomorrow."
"Oh, yes, that's all been arranged. If we've got to play hardball with these guys, we ought to be glad the game's going to be played on our home court. Extradition isn't the problem here."
"What is?"
"These people want to play knock over the dominoes. They want to knock your son over onto Will Darnell. Arnold is not talking. I want you two to get over here and persuade him that it's in his best interest to talk."
"Is it?" she had asked, hesitantly.
"Hell yes," Warburg's voice crackled back. "These guys don't want to put your son in jail. He's a minor from a good family with no previous criminal record, not even a school record of disciplinary problems. He can get out of this without even facing a judge, but he's got to talk."
So they had gone to Albany, and Regina had been taken down a short, narrow hallway faced in white tile, lit with high-intensity bulbs, sunken into small wells in the ceiling and covered with wire mesh. The place had smelled vaguely of Lysol and urine, and she kept trying to convince herself that her son was being held here. Her son! But achieving that conviction was a hard go. It didn't seem possible that it could be true. The possibility that it was all a hallucination seemed much more likely. Seeing Arnie had stripped away that possibility in a hurry. The protective jacket of shock was likewise stripped away, and she felt a cold, consuming fear. It was at this moment that she had first seized on the idea of getting us over this, the way a drowning person will seize a life preserver. It was Arnie. It was her son. Not in a jail cell. That was the only thing she had been spared, but she was grateful for even small favors. But in a small square room whose only furnishings were two chairs and a table scarred with cigarette burns. Arnie had looked at her steadily, and his face seemed horribly gaunt, skull-like. He had been to the barber only a week before and had gotten a surprisingly short haircut after years of wearing it long in emulation of Dennis. And now the overhead light shone down cruelly through what was left, making him appear momentarily bald, as if they had shaved his head to loosen his lips. "Arnie," she said, and went to him, halfway to him. He turned his head away from her, his lips pressing together, and she stopped. A lesser woman might have burst into tears then, but Regina was not a lesser woman. She let the coldness come back and have its way with her. The coldness was all that would help now. Instead of embracing him, something he obviously didn't want, she sat down and told him what had to be done. He refused. She ordered him to talk to the police. He refused again. She reasoned with him. He refused. She harangued him. He refused. She pleaded with him. He refused. Finally, she just sat there, dully, a headache thudding at her temples, and asked him why. He refused to tell her. "I thought you were smart," she shouted finally. She was nearly mad with frustration. The thing she hated above all others was not getting her way when she absolutely wanted to have it, needed to have it. This had, in fact, never happened to her since she left home. Until now. It was infuriating to be so smoothly and seamlessly balked by this boy who had once drawn milk from her breasts. "I thought you were smart, but you're stupid. You're an asshole. They'll put you in jail. Do you want to go to jail for that man, Darnell? Is that what you want? He'll laugh at you. He'll laugh at you." Regina could imagine nothing worse. And her son's apparent lack of interest in whether or not he was laughed at infuriated her all the more. She rose from her chair and pushed her hair away from her brow and eyes, the unconscious gesture of a person who is ready to fight. She was breathing rapidly, and her face was flushed. To Arnie, she looked both younger and much, much older than he had ever seen her.
"I'm not doing it for Darnell," he said quietly. "And I'm not going to jail."
"What are you, Oliver Wendell Holmes?" she rejoined fiercely, but her anger was in some measure overmastered by relief. At least he could say something. "They caught you in his car with the trunk loaded with cigarettes, illegal cigarettes." Mildly, Arnie said,
"They weren't in the trunk. They were in a compartment under the trunk, a secret compartment, and it was Will's car. Will told me to take his car."
She looked at him. "Are you saying you didn't know they were there?" Arnie looked at her with an expression she simply couldn't accept. It was so foreign to his face. It was contempt. "Good as gold. My boy's as good as gold," she thought crazily.
"I knew, and Will knew. But they have to prove it, don't they?"
She could only look at him, amazed.
"If they do drop it on me somehow," he said, "I'll get a suspended sentence."
"Arnie," she said at last, "you're not thinking straight. Maybe your father..."
"Yes," he interrupted, "I'm thinking straight. I don't know what you're doing, but I'm thinking very straight."
And he looked at her, his gray eyes so horribly blank that she could no longer stand it and had to leave. In the small green reception room, she walked blindly past her husband, who had been sitting on a bench with Warburg. "You go in," she said. "You make him see reason." She went on without waiting for his reply, not stopping until she was outside and the cold December air was painting her hot cheeks. Michael went in and had no better luck. He came out with nothing more than a dry throat and a face that looked 10 years older than it had going in. At the motel, Regina told Warburg what Arnie had said and asked him if there was any chance he might be right. Warburg looked thoughtful.
"Yes, that's a possible defense," he said. "But it would be a hell of a lot more possible if Arnie was the first domino in line. He's not. There's a used car dealer here in Albany named Henry Buck. He was the catcher. He's been arrested, too."
"What has he said?" Michael asked.
"I have no way of knowing, but when I tried to speak to his lawyer, he declined to speak with me. I find that ominous. If Buck talks, he puts the onus on Arnie. I'll bet you my house and lot that Buck can testify your son knew that secret compartment was there, and that's bad."
Warburg looked at them closely.
"You see, what your boy said to you was really only half smart, Mrs. Cunningham. I'll be talking to him tomorrow, before they move him back to Pennsylvania. What I hope to make him see is that there's a possibility this whole thing could come down on his head."
The first flakes of snow began to swirl out of the heavy sky as they turned onto Steve and Vicky Street.
"Is it snowing in Libertyville yet?"
Arnie wondered, and touched the keys on their leather tab in his pocket. Probably it was. Christine was still in Darnell's garage, impounded. That was all right. At least she was out of the weather. He would pick her up again. In time. The previous weekend was like a blurred bad dream. His parents, haranguing him in the little white room, had seemed to bear the disconnected faces of strangers. They were heads talking in a foreign language. The lawyer they had hired, Worley or Wormley or whatever, kept talking about something he called the domino theory and about the need to get out of the condemned building before the whole thing falls down on your head, boy. There are 2 states and 3 federal agencies bringing up the wrecking balls. But Arnie was more worried about Christine. It seemed clearer and clearer to him that Roland D. LeBay was either with him or hovering someplace near. He was perhaps coalescing inside him. This idea did not frighten Arnie. It comforted him. But he had to be careful. Not of Junkins. He felt that Junkins had only suspicions, and that they all lay in wrong directions, radiating out from Christine rather than in toward her. But Darnell? There could be problems with Will. Yes, real problems. That first night in Albany, after his mother and father had gone back to their motel, Arnie had been conducted to a holding cell, where he had fallen asleep with surprising ease and speed. And he had had a dream. Not quite a nightmare, but something that seemed terribly disquieting. He had awakened watchfully in the middle of the night, his body running with sweat. He had dreamed that Christine had been reduced in scale to a tiny 58 Plymouth, no longer than a man's hand. It was on a slot car track, surrounded by HO scale scenery that was amazingly apt. Here was a plastic street that could be Basin Drive. Here was another that could be JFK Drive, where Moochie Welch had been killed. A Lego building that looked exactly like Libertyville High, plastic houses, paper trees. And a gigantic, hulking Will Darnell was at the controls that dictated how fast or how slowly the tiny Fury ran through all of this. His breath wheezed in and out of his damaged lungs with a windstorm sound.
"You don't want to open your mouth, kiddo," Will said. He loomed over this scale-model world like the amazing colossal man. "You don't want to frig with me because I'm in control. I can do this."
And slowly, Will began to turn the control knob over toward Fast.
"No!" Arnie tried to scream. "No, don't do that! Please! I love her! Please! You'll kill her!"
On the track, the tiny Christine raced through the tiny Libertyville faster and faster, her rear end switching on the curves as she shimmied on the far edge of centrifugal force, that dish-shaped mystery. Now she was simply a blur of white over red, her engine a high, angry wasp whine. "Please!" Arnie screamed. "Please!" At last, Will had begun to turn the control back, looking grimly pleased. The little car began to slow down.
"If you start to get ideas, you just want to remember where your car is, kiddo. Keep your mouth shut, and we'll both live to fight another day. I've been in tighter jams than this."
Arnie had reached out to grasp the little car, to rescue it from the track. The dream Will had slapped his hand away.
"Whose bag is it, kiddo?"
"Will, please."
"Let me hear you say it."
"It's my bag."
"Just remember it, kiddo."
And Arnie had awakened with that in his ears. There had been no more sleep for him that night. Was it so unlikely that Will would know, well, would know something about Christine? No, he saw a great deal from behind that window, but he knew how to keep his mouth shut, at least until the time was right to open it. He might know what Junkins did not, that Christine's regeneration in November was not just strange, but totally impossible. He would know that a lot of the repairs had never been made, at least not by Arnie. What else would he know? With a creeping coldness that moved up his legs to the root of his guts, Arnie realized at last that Will could have been at the garage the night Repperton and the others had died. In fact, it was more than possible. It was probable. Jimmy Sykes was simple, and Will didn't like to trust him alone.
"You don't want to open your mouth. You don't want to frig with me because I can do this."
But even supposing Will knew, who would believe him? It was too late for self-delusion now, and Arnie could no longer put the unthinkable thought away from himself. He no longer even wanted to. Who would believe Will if Will decided to tell someone that Christine sometimes ran by herself, that she had been out on her own the night Moochie Welch was killed and the night those other hoods were killed? Would the police believe that? They would laugh themselves into a hemorrhage. Junkins getting warmer. But Arnie didn't believe Junkins would be able to accept such a thing, even if he wanted to. Arnie had seen his eyes. So even if Will did know, what good would his knowledge do? Then, with mounting horror, Arnie realized that it didn't matter. Will would be out on bail tomorrow or the next day, and then Christine would be his hostage. He could torch it. He had torched plenty of cars in his time, as Arnie knew from sitting in the office and listening to him yarn. And after she was torched, a burned hulk, helpless, there was the crusher out back. In goes the cindered hulk of Christine on the conveyor belt. Out comes a smashed cube of metal. The cops have sealed the place, but that didn't cut any ice either. Will Darnell was a very old fox, and he stayed prepared for any contingency. If Will wanted to get in and torch Christine, he would do it. Although it was much more likely, Arnie thought, that he would hire an insurance specialist to do the job, a guy who would throw double handfuls of charcoal lighter cubes into the car and then toss a match. In his mind's eye, Arnie could see the blossoming flames. He could smell charring upholstery. He lay on the cell bunk, his mouth dry, his heart beating rapidly in his chest.
"You don't want to open your mouth. You don't want to frig with me."
Of course, if Will tried something and got careless, if his concentration lapsed for even a moment, Christine would get him. But somehow Arnie didn't think Will would get careless. The next day, he had been taken back to Pennsylvania, charged, then bailed for a nominal sum. There would be a preliminary hearing in January, and there was already talk of a grand jury. The bust was front-page material across the state, although Arnie was only identified as a youth, whose name was being withheld by state and federal authorities due to his minor status. Arnie's name was common enough knowledge in Libertyville, however. In spite of its new exurban sprawl of drive-ins, fast-food emporiums, and bowl-o-ramas, it was still a faculty town, where a lot of people were living in other people's back pockets. These people, mostly associated with Horlicks University, knew who had been driving for Will Darnell, and who had been arrested over the New York state line, with a trunk full of contraband cigarettes. It was Regina's nightmare. Arnie went home in the custody of his parents, bailed for $1,000, after a brief detour to jail. It was all nothing but a big shitting game of Monopoly, really. His parents had come up with the get-out-of-jail-free card, as expected. "What are you smiling about, Arnie?" Regina asked him. Michael was driving the wagon along at fast walking speed, looking through the swirls of snow for Steve and Vicky's ranch house.
"Was I smiling?"
"Yes," she said, and touched his hair.
"I don't really remember," he said remotely,
and she took her hand away. They had come home on Sunday, and his parents had left him pretty much alone, either because they didn't know how to talk to him, or because they were utterly disgusted with him. Or perhaps it was a combination of the two. He didn't give a crap which, and that was the truth. He felt washed out, exhausted, a ghost of himself. His mother had gone to bed and slept all that afternoon, after taking the telephone off the hook. His father puttered aimlessly in his workroom, running his electric planer periodically and then shutting it off. Arnie sat in the living room, watching a football playoff doubleheader, not knowing who was playing, not caring, content to watch the players run around, first in bright, warm California sunshine, later in a mixture of rain and sleet that turned the playing field to churned up mud and erased the lines. Around 6 o'clock, he dozed off and dreamed. He dreamed again that night and the next, in the bed where he had slept since earliest childhood, the elm outside casting its old, familiar shadow, a skeleton each winter that gained miraculous new flesh each May. These dreams were not like the dream of the giant Will looming over the slot car track. He could not remember these dreams at all, more than a few moments after waking. Perhaps that was just as well. A figure by the roadside, a fleshless finger tapping a decayed palm in a lunatic parody of instruction, an uneasy sense of freedom and escape? Yes, escape. Nothing else except, yes, he escaped from these dreams and back into reality with one repeating image. He was behind the wheel of Christine, driving slowly through a howling blizzard, snow so thick that he could literally see no farther than the end of her hood. The wind was not a scream, it was a lower, more sinister sound, a basso roar. Then the image had changed. The snow wasn't snow any longer, it was ticker tape. The roar of the wind was the roar of a great crowd lining both sides of Fifth Avenue. They were cheering him, they were cheering Christine, they were cheering because he and Christine had escaped. Each time this confused dream retreated, he thought, "When this is over, I'm getting out. Getting out for sure. Going to drive to Mexico." And Mexico, as he imagined, its steady sun and its rural quiet, seemed more real than the dreams. Shortly after awakening from the last of these dreams, the idea of spending Christmas with Aunt Vicky and Uncle Steve, just like in the old days, had come to him. He awoke with it, and it clanged in his head with a peculiar persistence. The idea seemed to be an awfully good one, an all-important one, to get out of Libertyville before, well, before Christmas. What else? So he began talking to his mother and father about it, coming down particularly hard on Regina. On Wednesday, she abruptly gave in and agreed. He knew she had talked to Vicky, and Vicky hadn't been inclined to lord it over her. So it was all right. Now, on Christmas Eve, he felt that everything would soon be all right. "There it is, Mike," Regina said, "and you're going to drive right by it just like you do every time we come here." Michael grunted and turned into the driveway. "I saw it," he said, in the perpetually defensive tone he always seemed to use around his wife.
He's a donkey, Arnie thought. She talks to him like a donkey, she rides him like a donkey, and he brays like a donkey.
You're smiling again, Regina said.
I was just thinking about how much I love you both, Arnie said.
His father looked at him, surprised and touched. There was a soft gleam in his mother's eyes that might have been tears.
They really believed it. The shitters.
By 3 o'clock that Christmas Eve, the snow was still only isolated flurries, although the flurries were beginning to blend into each other. The delay in the storm's arrival was not good news, the weather forecasters said. It had compacted itself and turned even more vicious. Predictions of possible accumulations had gone from a foot to a possible 18 inches, with serious drifting and high winds. Lee Cabot sat in the living room of her house, across from a small, natural Christmas tree that was already beginning to shed its needles. In her house, she was the voice of traditionalism, and for 4 years had successfully staved off her father's wish for a synthetic tree and her mother's wish to kick off the holiday season with a goose or a capon instead of the traditional Thanksgiving turkey. She was alone in the house. Her mother and father had gone over to the Stewarts for Christmas Eve drinks. Mr. Stewart was her father's new boss, and they liked each other. This was a friendship Mrs. Cabot was eager to promote. In the last 10 years, they had moved 6 times, hopping all over the eastern seaboard, and of all the places they had been, her mom liked Libertyville the best. She wanted to stay here, and her husband's friendship with Mr. Stewart could go a long way toward ensuring that.
All alone and still a virgin, she thought.
That was an utterly stupid thing to think, but all the same, she got up suddenly, as if stung. She went into the kitchen, overconscious of that Formica Wonderland's little servo sounds. Electric clock, the oven where a ham was baking. Turn that off at 5 if they're not back, she reminded herself. A cool clunk from the freezer as the Frigidaire's ice maker made another cube. She opened the fridge, saw a 6-pack of Coke sitting in there next to Daddy's beer, and thought, "Get thee behind me, Satan." Then she grabbed a can anyway. Never mind what it did to her complexion. She wasn't going with anyone now. If she broke out, so what? The empty house made her uneasy. It never had before. She had always felt pleased and absurdly competent when they left her alone. A holdover from childhood days, no doubt. The house had always seemed comforting to her. But now the sounds of the kitchen, of the rising wind outside, even the scuff of her slippers on the linoleum, those sounds seemed sinister. Even frightening. If things had worked out differently, Arnie could have been here with her. Her folks, especially her mother, had liked him. At first. Now, of course, after what had happened, her mother would probably wash her mouth out with soap if she knew Lee was even thinking of him. But she did think of him. Too much of the time. Wondering why he had changed. Wondering how he was taking the breakup. Wondering if he was okay. The wind rose to a shriek, and then fell off a little, reminding her, for no reason, of course, of a car's engine revving, and then falling off. Her mind whispered strangely, and for no reason at all, of course, she went to the sink and poured her Coke down the drain and wondered if she was going to cry, or throw up, or what. She realized with dawning surprise that she was in a state of low terror, for no reason at all, of course. At least her parents had left the car in the garage. Cars. She had cars on the brain. She didn't like to think of her dad trying to drive home from the Stewarts in this, half-soused from 3 or 4 martinis, except that he always called them martoonies, with typical adult kittenishness. It was only 3 blocks, and the two of them had left the house bundled up and giggling, looking like a couple of large children on their way to make a snowman. The walk home would sober them up. It would be good for them. It would be good for them if... The wind rose again, gunning around the eaves and then falling off, and she suddenly saw her mother and father walking up the street through clouds of blowing snow, holding on to each other to keep from falling on their drunken, lovable asses, laughing. Daddy may be goosing Mom through her snow pants. The way he sometimes goosed her when he got a buzz on was also something that had always irritated Lee, precisely because it seemed such a juvenile thing for a grown man to do. But, of course, she loved them both. Her love was a part of the irritation, and her occasional exasperation with them was very much a part of her love. They were walking together through a snow as thick as heavy smoke, and then two huge green eyes opened in the white behind them, seeming to float, eyes that looked terribly like the circles of the dashboard instruments she had seen as she was choking to death, and they were growing, stalking her helpless, laughing, squiffy parents. She drew a harsh breath and went back into the living room. She approached the telephone, almost touched it, then veered away and went back to the window, looking out into the white and cupping her elbows in the palms of her hands. What had she been about to do? Call them? Tell them she was alone in the house and had gotten to thinking about Arnie's old and somehow slinking car, his steel girlfriend Christine, and that she wanted them to come home because she was scared for them and herself? Was that what she was going to do? Cutely. Cute. The plowed blacktop of the street was disappearing under new snow, but slowly. It had only just begun to snow really hard, and the wind periodically tried to clear the street with strong gusts that sent membranes of powder twisting and rising to merge with the whitish-gray sky of this stormy afternoon, like slowly twisting smoke ghosts. Oh, but the terror was there. It was real. And something was going to happen. She knew it. She had been shocked to hear that Arnie had been arrested for smuggling, but that reaction had been nowhere as strong as the sick fear she had felt when she opened the paper on an earlier day and saw what had happened to Buddy Repperton and those other two boys. That day when her first crazy, terrible, and somehow certain thought had been Christine. And now the premonition of some new piece of black work hung heavily on her, and she couldn't get rid of it. It was crazy. Arnie had been in Philadelphia at a chess tourney. She had asked around that day. That was all there was to it, and she would not think about this anymore. She would turn on all the radios, the TV, fill up the house with sound, not think about that car that smelled like the grave, that car that had tried to kill her, murder her. Oh, damn, she whispered. Can't you quit? Her arms sculpted rigidly in goose flesh. Abruptly, she went to the telephone again, found the phone book, and, as Arnie had done on an evening some 2 weeks before, she called Libertyville Community Hospital. A pleasant-voiced receptionist told her that Mr. Gilder had been checked out that morning. Lee thanked her and hung up. She stood thoughtful in the empty living room, looking at the small tree, the presents, the manger in the corner. Then she looked up the Gilder's number in the phone book, and dialed it.
"Lee," Dennis said, happily pleased. The phone in her hand felt cold.
"Dennis, can I come over and talk to you?"
"Today?" he asked, surprised.
Confused thoughts tumbled through her mind. The ham in the oven. She had to turn the oven off at 5. Her parents would be home. It was Christmas Eve. The snow, and she didn't think it would be safe to be out tonight. Out walking on the sidewalks. When anything might come looming out of the snow. Anything at all. Not tonight. That was the worst. She didn't think it would be safe to be out tonight.
Lee?
Not tonight, she said. I'm house-sitting for my folks. They're at a cocktail party.
Yeah, mine too, Dennis said, amused. My sister and I are playing Parcheesi. She cheats.
Faintly. I do not.
At another time, it might have been funny. It wasn't now.
After Christmas, maybe on Tuesday, the 26th, would that be all right?
Sure, he said. Lee, is it about Arnie?
No,
she said, clutching the telephone so tightly that her hand felt numb. She had to struggle with her voice.
No, not Arnie. I want to talk to you about Christine.
Chapter 42. The Storm Breaks. By 5 o'clock that evening, the storm had blanketed Pennsylvania. It screamed across the state from border to border, its howling throat full of snow. There was no final Christmas Eve rush, and most of the weary and shell-shocked clerks and salespeople were grateful to Mother Nature in spite of the missed overtime. There would, they told each other over Christmas Eve drinks in front of freshly kindled fires, be plenty of that when returns started on Tuesday. Mother Nature didn't seem all that motherly that evening, as early dusk gave way to full dark and then to blizzardy night. She was a pagan, fearsome old witch that night, a harridan on the wind, and Christmas meant nothing to her. She ripped down Chamber of Commerce tinsel and sent it gusting high into the black sky. She blew the large nativity scene in front of the police station into a snowbank, where the sheep, the goats, the Holy Mother and child were not found until a late January thaw uncovered them. And as a final spit in the eye of the holiday season, she tipped over the 40-foot tree that had stood in front of the Libertyville Municipal Building and sent it through a big window and into the town tax assessor's office. A good place for it, many said later. By 7 o'clock, the plows had begun to fall behind. A Trailways bus bowled its way up Main Street at 7:15, a short line of cars dogging its silvery rump like puppies behind their mother. And then the street was empty, except for a few slant-parked cars that had already been buried to the bumpers by the passing plows. By morning, most of them would be buried entirely. At the intersection of Main Street and Basin Drive, a stop-and-go light that directed no one at all twisted and danced from its power cable in the wind. There was a sudden electrical fizzing noise, and the light went dark. Two or three passengers from the last city bus of the day were crossing the street at the time. They glanced up and then hurried on. By 8 o'clock, when Mr. and Mrs. Cabot finally arrived home, to Lee's great but unspoken relief, the local radio stations were broadcasting a plea from the Pennsylvania State Police for everyone to stay off the roads. By 9 o'clock, as Michael, Regina, and Arnie Cunningham, equipped with hot rum punches, Uncle Steve's avowed specialty of the season, were gathering around the television with Uncle Steve and Aunt Vicky to watch Alistair Sim in A Christmas Carol, a 40-mile stretch of the Pennsylvania Turnpike had been closed by drifting snow. By midnight, almost all of it would be closed. By 9:30, when Christine's headlights suddenly came on in Will Darnell's deserted garage, cutting a bright arc through the interior blackness, Libertyville had totally shut down, except for the occasional cruising plows. In the silent garage, Christine's engine gunned and fell off. Gunned and fell off. In the empty front seat, the gear shift lever dropped down into drive. Christine began to move. The electric eye gadget clipped to the driver's sun visor hummed briefly. Its low sound was lost in the howl of the wind, but the door heard. It rattled upward obediently on its tracks. Snow blew in and swirled gustily. Christine passed outside, wraith-like in the snow. She turned right and moved down the street, her tires cutting through the deep snow cleanly and firmly, with no spin, skid, or hesitation. A turn blinker came on, one amber-winking eye in the snow. She turned left, toward JFK Drive. Don Vandenberg sat behind the desk inside the office of his father's gas station. Both his feet and his pecker were up. He was reading one of his father's fuck books, a deeply incisive and thought-provoking tome titled Swap Around Pammy. Pammy had gotten it from just about everyone but the milkman and the dog, and the milkman was coming up the drive and the dog was lying at her feet when the bell dinged, signaling a customer. Don looked up impatiently. He had called his father at 6, 4 hours ago, and asked him if he shouldn't close the station down. There wouldn't be enough business tonight to pay for the electricity it took to light up the sign. His father, sitting home warm and toasty and safely shit-faced, had told him to keep it open until midnight. If there ever was a Scrooge, Don thought resentfully as he slammed the phone back down, his old man was it. The simple fact was, he didn't like being alone at night anymore. Once, and not so long ago at that, he would have had plenty of company. Buddy would have been there, and Buddy was a magnet, drawing the others with his booze, his occasional gram of coke, but most of all with the simple force of his personality. But now they were gone. All gone. Except sometimes it seemed to Don that they weren't. Sometimes it seemed to him, when he was alone, as he was tonight, that he might look up and see them sitting there. Richie Trelawney on one side, Moochie Welch on the other, and Buddy between them, with a bottle of Texas Driver in his hand and a joint cocked behind his ear. Horribly white, all three of them, like vampires, their eyes as glazed as the eyes of dead fish, and Buddy would hold out the bottle and whisper, "Get yourself a drink, asshole. Pretty soon you'll be dead like us." These fantasies were sometimes real enough to leave him with his mouth dry and his hands shaking. And the reason why wasn't lost on Don. They never should have trashed old Cunface's car that night.
Every single one of the guys in on that little prank had died horrible deaths. All of them, that was, except for him and Sandy Galton. And Sandy had gotten in that old broken-down Mustang of his and taken off somewhere. On these long night shifts, Don often thought he would like to do the same. Outside, the customer beeped his horn. Don slammed the book down on the desk next to the greasy credit card machine and struggled into his parka, peering out at the car and wondering who would be crazy enough to be out in a shitstorm like this one. In the blowing snow, it was impossible to tell anything about either the car or the customer. He could make out nothing for sure but the headlights and the shape of the body, which was too long for a new car. Someday, he thought, drawing on his gloves and bidding a reluctant farewell to his hard-on, his father would put in self-service pumps and all this shit would end. If people were crazy enough to be out on a night like this, they should have to pump their own gas. The door almost ripped itself out of his hand. He held onto it so it wouldn't slam back into the cinder block side of the building and maybe shatter the glass. He almost went down on his ass for his pains. In spite of the steady hooting of the wind, which he had been trying not to hear, he had totally misjudged the force of the storm. The very depth of the snow, better than 8 inches, helped to keep him on his feet. That fucking car must be on snowshoes, he thought resentfully. Guy gives me a credit card, I'm gonna fuse his spine. He waded through the snow, approaching the first set of islands. The fuckstick had parked at the far set. Naturally. Don tried to glance up once, but the wind threw snow into his face in a stinging sheet, and he lowered his head quickly, letting the top of the parka's hood take the brunt of it. He crossed in front of the car, bathed for a moment in the bright but heatless glow of its dual headlights. He struggled and floundered around at the driver's side. The pump island's fluorescence made the car into a garish white-over-purple-burgundy shade. His cheeks were already numb. If this guy wants a dollar's worth and asks me to check the oil, I'm telling him to cram it, he thought, and raised his head into the sting of the snow as the window went down. Can I... he began, and the H sound of help you became a high, hissing, strengthless scream. Leaning out of the window, less than 6 inches from his own face, was a rotting corpse. Its eyes were wide, empty sockets. Its mummified lips were drawn back from a few yellowed, leaning teeth. One hand lay whitely on the steering wheel. The other, clicking horridly, reached out to touch him. Don floundered backward, his heart a runaway engine in his chest, his terror a monstrous hot rock in his throat. The dead thing beckoned him, grinning, and the car's engine suddenly screamed, piling up revs. Fill it up, the corpse whispered, and in spite of his shock and horror, Don saw it was wearing the tattered and moss-slimed remains of an army uniform. Fill it up, you shitter! Skull teeth grinned in the fluorescent light. Far back in that mouth, a bit of gold twinkled. Catch yourself a drink, asshole, another voice whispered hoarsely, and Buddy Repperton leaned forward in the back seat, extending a bottle of Texas Driver toward Don. Worms spilled and squirmed through his grin. Beetles crawled in what remained of his hair. I think you must need one. Don shrieked, the sound bulleting up and out of him. He whirled away, running through the snow in great leaping cartoon steps. He shrieked again as the car's engine screamed V8 power. He looked back over his shoulder and saw that it was Christine standing by the pumps. Arnie's Christine, now moving, churning snow up behind her rear tires. And the things he had seen were gone. That was even worse, somehow. The things were gone. The car was moving on its own. He had turned toward the street, and now he climbed up over the snowbank thrown up by the passing plows and down the other side. Here the wind had swept the pavement clear of everything except an occasional blister of ice. Don skidded on one of these. His feet went out from under him. He landed on his back with a thump. A moment later, the street was flooded with white light. Don rolled over and looked up, eyes straining wildly in their sockets, in time to see the huge white circles of Christine's headlights as she slammed through the snowbank and bore down on him like a locomotive. Like Gaul, all of Libertyville Heights was divided into three parts. The semicircle closest to town on the low shoal of hills that had been known as Liberty Lookout until the mid-19th century, a bicentennial plaque on the corner of Rogers and Tacklin Streets so reminded, was the town's only real poor section.
It was an unhappy warren of apartments and wooden frame buildings. Rope clotheslines spanned scruffy backyards, which were, in more temperate seasons, littered with kids and Fisher-Price toys. In too many cases, both kids and toys had been badly battered. This neighborhood, once middle class, had been growing tackier ever since the war jobs had dried up in 1945. The decline moved slowly at first, then began to gain speed in the 60s and early 70s. Now the worst yet had come, although nobody could come right out and say it, at least not in public, where he or she could be quoted. Now, the blacks were moving in. It was said in private, in the better parts of town, over barbecues and drinks. The blacks, God help us, the blacks are discovering Libertyville. The area had even gained its own name, not Liberty Lookout, but the Low Heights. It was a name many found chillingly ghetto-ish. The editor of the Keystone had been quietly informed by several of his biggest advertisers that to use that phrase in print, thus legitimizing it, would make them very unhappy. The editor, whose mother had raised no fools, never did so. Heights Avenue split off from Basin Drive in Libertyville proper, and then began to rise. It cut cleanly through the middle of the Low Heights, and then left them behind. The road then climbed through a greenbelt and into a residential area. This section of town was known simply as the Heights. All this might seem confusing to you, Heights this and Heights that, but Libertyville residents knew what they were talking about. When you said the Low Heights, you meant poverty, genteel or otherwise. When you left off the adjective low, you meant poverty's direct opposite. Here were fine old homes, most of them set tastefully back from the road, some of the finest behind thick yew hedges. Libertyville's movers and shakers lived here. The newspaper publisher, four doctors, the rich and dotty granddaughter of the man who had invented the rapid-fire ejection system for automatic pistols. Most of the rest were lawyers. Beyond this area of respectable small-town wealth, Heights Avenue passed through a wooded area that was really too thick to be called a greenbelt. The woods lined both sides of the road for more than 3 miles. At the highest point of the Heights, Stanson Road branched off to the left, dead-ending at the embankment, overlooking the town and the Libertyville drive-in. On the other side of this low mountain, but also known as the Heights, was a fairly old middle-class neighborhood, where houses 40 and 50 years old were slowly mellowing. As this area began to thin out into countryside, Heights Avenue became County Road Number 2. At 10:30 on that Christmas Eve, a 1958 two-tone Plymouth moved up Heights Avenue, its lights cutting through the snow-choked, raving dark. Long-time natives of the Heights would have said that nothing, except maybe a four-wheel drive, could have gotten up Heights Avenue that night. But Christine moved along at a steady 30 miles an hour, headlights probing, wipers moving rhythmically back and forth, totally empty within. Its fresh tracks were alone, and in places they were almost a foot deep. The steady wind filled them in quickly. Now and again her front bumper and hood would explode through the ridged back of a snowdrift, nosing the powder aside, easily. Christine passed the Stanson Road turnoff and the embankment, where Arnie and Lee had once trysted. She reached the top of Liberty Heights and headed down the far side, at first through black woods cut only by the white ribbon that marked the road, then past the suburban houses, with their cozy living room lights and, in some cases, their cheery trim of Christmas lights. In one of these houses, a young man, who had just finished playing Santa and who was having a drink with his wife to celebrate, happened to glance out and see headlights passing by. He pointed it out to her. "If that guy came over the Heights tonight," this young man said with a grin, "he must have had the devil riding shotgun." "Never mind that," she said. "Now that the kids are taken care of, what do I get from Santa?" He grinned. "We'll think of something." Farther down the road, almost at the point where the Heights ceased being the Heights, Will Darnell sat in the living room of the simple two-story frame house he had owned for 30 years. He was wearing a bald and fading blue terry cloth robe over his pajama bottoms, his huge sack of stomach pushing out like a swollen moon. He was watching the final conversion of Ebenezer Scrooge to the side of goodness and generosity, but not really seeing it. His mind was once more sifting through the pieces of a puzzle that grew steadily more fascinating. Arnie, Welch, Repperton, Christine.
Will had aged a decade in the week or so since the bust. He had told that cop, Mercer, that he would be back doing business at the same old stand in 2 weeks. But in his heart, he wondered. It seemed that lately his throat was always slimy from the taste of that goddamn aspirator. Arnie. Welch. Repperton. Christine.
Boy!
Scrooge hailed down from his window, a caricature of the Christmas spirit in his nightgown and cap.
Is the prize turkey still in the butcher's window?
What?
The boy asked.
The one as big as I am?
Yes, yes,
Scrooge answered, giggling wildly. It was as if the three spirits had, instead of saving him, driven him mad.
The one as big as you are.
Arnie, Welch, Repperton, LeBay? Sometimes he thought it was not the bust that had tired him out and made him feel so constantly beaten and afraid. That it was not even the fact that they had busted his pet accountant, or that the federal tax people were in on it and were obviously loaded for bear this time. The tax people weren't the reason that he had begun scanning the street before going out mornings. The state attorney general's office didn't have anything to do with the sudden glances he had begun throwing back over his shoulder when he was driving home nights from the garage. He had gone over what he had seen that night, or what he thought he had seen, again and again, trying to convince himself that it was absolutely not real, or that it absolutely was. For the first time in years, he found himself doubting his own senses. And as the event receded into the past, it became easier to believe he had fallen asleep and dreamed the whole thing. He hadn't seen Arnie since the bust, or tried to call him on the telephone. At first, he had thought to use his knowledge about Christine as a lever to keep Arnie's mouth shut if the kid weakened and took a notion to talk. God knew the kid could go a long way toward sending him to jail if he cooperated with the cops. It wasn't until after the police had landed everywhere that Will realized how much the kid knew, and he had had a few panicky moments of self-appraisal, something else that was upsetting because it was so foreign to his nature. Had all of them known that much? Repperton and all the hoodie Repperton clones stretching back over the years? Could he actually have been so stupid? No, he decided. It was only Cunningham, because Cunningham was different. He seemed to understand things almost intuitively. He wasn't all brag and booze and bullshit. In a queer way, Will felt almost fatherly toward the boy. Not that he would have hesitated to cut the kid loose if it started to look as if he was going to rock the boat. And not that I'd hesitate now, he assured himself. On the TV, a scratchy black-and-white Scrooge was with the Cratchits. The film was almost over. The whole bunch of them looked like loonies, and that was the truth. But Scrooge was definitely the worst. The look of mad joy in his eye was not so different from the look in the eye of a man Will had known 20 years before, a fellow named Everett Dingle, who had gone home from the garage one afternoon and murdered his entire family. Will lit a cigar, anything to take the taste of the aspirator out of his mouth, that rotten taste. Lately it seemed harder than ever to catch his breath. Damn cigars didn't help, but he was too old to change now. The kid hadn't talked, at least not yet he hadn't. They had turned Henry Buck, Will's lawyer had told him. Henry, who was 63 and a grandfather, would have denied Christ 3 times if they had promised him a dismissal or even a suspended sentence in return. Old Henry Buck was sicking up everything he knew, which fortunately wasn't a great deal. He knew about the fireworks and cigarettes, but that had only been 2 rings of what had been at one time a 6- or 7-ring circus encompassing booze, hot cars, discount firearms, including a few machine guns sold to gun nuts and homicidal hunters who wanted to see if one would really tear up a deer like I heard, and stolen antiques from New England. And in the last couple of years, cocaine. That had been a mistake. He knew it now. Those Colombians down in Miami were as crazy as shithouse rats. Come to think of it, they were shithouse rats. Thank Christ they hadn't caught the kid holding a pound of coke. Well, they were going to hurt him this time. How much or how little depended a great deal on that weird 17-year-old kid and maybe on his weird car. Things were as delicately balanced as a house of cards, and Will hesitated to do or say anything for fear he would change things for the worse. And there was always the possibility that Cunningham would laugh in his face and call him crazy. Will got up, cigar clamped in his jaws, and shut off his television set. He should go to bed.
but maybe he would have a brandy first. He was always tired now, but sleep came hard. He turned toward the kitchen, and that was when the horn began to honk outside. The sound came over the howl of the wind in short, imperative blasts. Will stopped cold in the kitchen doorway and belted his robe closed across his big stomach. His face was sharp and rapt and alive, suddenly the face of a much younger man. He stood there a moment longer. Three more short, sharp honks. He turned back, taking the cigar from his mouth, and walked slowly across the living room. An almost dreamlike sense of déjà vu washed over him like warm water. Mixed with it was a feeling of fatalism. He knew it was Christine out there, even before he brushed the curtain back and looked out. She had come for him, as he supposed he knew she might. The car stood at the head of his turnaround driveway, little more than a ghost in the membranes of blowing snow. Its bright shone out in widening cones that at last disappeared into the storm. For a moment it seemed to Will that someone was behind the wheel, but he blinked again and saw that the car was empty. As empty as it had been when it returned to the garage that night.
Honk, 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 honk.
Almost as if it were talking. Will's heart thudded heavily in his chest. He turned abruptly to the phone. The time had come to call Cunningham after all, call him and tell him to bring his pet demon to heel. He was halfway there when he heard the car's engine scream. The sound was like the shriek of a woman who sensed treachery. A moment later, there was a heavy crunch. Will went back to the window and was in time to see the car backing away from the high snowbank that fronted the end of his driveway. Its hood, sprayed with clods of snow, had crimped slightly. The engine revved again. The rear wheels spun in the powdery snow and then caught hold. The car leaped across the snowy road and struck the snowbank again. More snow exploded up and raftered away on the wind like cigar smoke blown in front of a fan.
Never do it, Will thought. And even if you get into the driveway, what then? You think I'm going to come out and play?
Wheezing more sharply than ever, he went back to the phone, looked up Cunningham's home number, and started to dial it. His fingers jittered, he misdialed, swore, hit the cutoff buttons, started again. Outside, Christine's engine revved. A moment later, there was a crunch as she hit the embankment for the third time. The wind wailed and snow struck the big picture window like dry sand. Will licked his lips and tried to breathe slowly, but his throat was closing up. He could feel it. The phone began to ring on the other end. Three times. Four. Christine's engine screamed, then the heavy thud as she hit the snowbank the passing plows had piled up at both ends of Will's semicircular driveway. Six rings. Seven. Nobody home.
Shit on it, Will whispered, and slammed the phone back down. His face was pale, his nostrils flared wide, like the nostrils of an animal scenting fire upwind.
His cigar had gone out. He threw it on the carpet and groped to his bathrobe pocket as he hurried back to the window. His hand found the comforting shape of his aspirator, and his fingers curled around its pistol grip. Headlights shone momentarily in his face, nearly blinding him, and Will raised his free hand to shield his eyes. Christine hit the snowbank again. Little by little, she was bludgeoning her way through to the driveway. He watched her back up across the road and wished savagely for a plow to come along now and hit the damn thing broadside. No plow came. Christine came again instead, engine howling, lights glaring across his snow-covered lawn. She struck the snowbank, pushing mounds of snow violently to either side. The front end canted up, and for a moment, Will thought she was going to come right over what was left of the frozen, hard-packed embankment. Then the rear wheels lost traction and spun frantically. She backed up. Will's throat felt as if its bore was down to a pinhole. His lungs strained for air. He took the aspirator out and used it. The police. He ought to call the police. They would come. Cunningham's 58 couldn't get him. He was safe in his house. He was... Christine came again, accelerating across the road, and this time she hit the bank and came over it easily, front end at first tilting up, splashing the front of his house with light, then crashing back down. She was in the driveway. Yes, all right. But she could come no further. She... it.
Christine never slowed, still accelerating. She crossed the semicircular driveway on a tangent, plowed through the shallower, looser snow of the side yard, and roared directly at the picture window where Will Darnell stood, looking out. He staggered backward, gasping hard, and tripped over his own easy chair. Christine hit the house. The picture window exploded, letting in the shrieking wind. Glass flew in deadly arrows, each of them reflecting Christine's headlamps. Snow blew in and danced over the rug in erratic corkscrews. The headlights momentarily illuminated the room with the unnatural glare of a television studio. And then she withdrew, her front bumper dragging, her hood popped up, her grill smashed into a chrome-dripping grin full of fangs. Will was on his hands and knees, gagging harshly for breath, his chest heaving. He was vaguely aware that, had he not tripped over his chair and fallen down, he probably would have been cut to ribbons by flying glass. His robe had come undone and flapped behind him as he got to his feet. The wind streaming in the window picked up the TV guide from the little table by his chair, and the magazine flew across the room to the foot of the stairs, pages riffling. Will got the telephone in both hands and dialed zero. Christine reversed along her own tracks through the snow. She went all the way back to the flattened snowbank at the entrance to the driveway. Then she came forward, accelerating rapidly, and as she came, the hood immediately began to uncrimp, the grill to regenerate itself. She slammed into the side of the house below the picture window again. More glass flew, wood splintered and groaned and creaked. The big window's low ledge cracked in two, and for a moment Christine's windshield, now cracked and milky, seemed to peer in like a giant alien eye.
"Police," Will said to the operator. His voice was hardly there. It was all wheeze and whistle.
His bathrobe flapped in the cold blizzard wind coming in through the shattered window. He saw that the wall below the window was nearly shattered. Broken chunks of lathing protruded like fractured bones. It couldn't get in. Could it? Could it?
"I'm sorry, sir. You'll have to speak up," the operator said. "We seem to have a very bad connection."
"Police," Will said, but this time it wasn't even a whisper, only a hiss of air. Dear God, he was strangling. He was choking. His chest was a locked bank vault. Where was his aspirator?
"Sir?"
the operator asked, doubtfully. There it was, on the floor. Will dropped the telephone and scrabbled for it. Christine came again, roaring across the lawn and striking the side of the house. This time the entire wall gave way in a shrapnel burst of glass and lathing, and, incredibly, nightmarishly, Christine's smashed and dented hood was in his living room. She was in. He could smell exhaust and hot engine. Christine's underworks caught on something, and she reversed back out of the ragged hole with a screech of pulling boards, her front end a gored ruin dusted with snow and plaster. But she would come again in a few seconds, and this time she might. Just might. Will grabbed his respirator and ran blindly for the stairs. He was only halfway up when the revving whine of her engine came again, and he turned to watch, leaning on the railing more than grasping it. The stairwell's height lent a certain nightmare perspective. He watched Christine come across the snow-covered lawn, saw her hood fly up so that now her front end resembled the mouth of a huge red-and-white alligator. Then it snapped off altogether as she struck the house again, this time doing better than 40. She ripped away the last of the window frame and sprayed more splintered boards across his living room. Her headlights bounced upward, glaring, and then she was in. She was in his house, leaving a huge, torn hole in the wall behind her with an electrical cable hanging out onto the rug like a black, severed artery. Little clouds of blown-in fiberglass insulation danced on the cold wind like milkweed puffs. Will screamed and couldn't hear himself over the blatting roar of her engine. The Sears muzzler Arnie had put on her, one of the few things he really put on her, Will thought crazily, had hung up on the sill of the house, along with most of the tailpipe. The fury roared across the living room, knocking Will's lazy boy armchair onto its side, where it lay like a dead pony. The floor under Christine creaked uneasily, and a part of Will's mind screamed, "Yes! Break! Break! Spill the goddamn thing into the cellar! Let's see it climb out of there!" And this image was replaced with the image of a tiger in a pit that had been dug and then camouflaged by wily natives. But the floor held, at least for the time being. It held. Christine roared across the living room at him. Behind, she left a zigzag pattern of snowy tire prints on the rug. She slammed into the stairs. Will was thrown back against the wall. His aspirator fell out of his hand and tumbled end over end all the way to the bottom. Christine reversed across the room, floorboards groaning underneath. Her rear end stuck the Sony TV and the picture tube imploded. She roared forward again and struck the side of the stairs again, shattering lath and gouging out plaster. Will could feel the entire structure grow wobbly under him. There was an awful sensation of lean. For a moment, Christine was directly beneath him. He could look down into the oily gut of her engine compartment, could feel the heat of her V8 mill. She reversed again, and Will scrambled up the stairs, heaving for air, clawing at the fat sausage of his throat, eyes bulging. He reached the top an instant before Christine hit the wall again, turning the center of the stairs into a jumbled wreck. A long splinter of wood fell into her engine. The fan chewed it up and spat out coarse-grained sawdust and smaller splinters. The entire house smelled of gas and exhaust. Will's ears rang with the heavy thunder of that merciless engine. She backed up again. Now her tires had chewed ragged trenches in the carpet. Down the hall, Will thought. Attic. Attic'll be safe. Yes, the at... Oh, God. Oh, God. Oh, my God! The final pain came with sharp, spiking suddenness. It was as if his heart had been punctured with an icicle, his left arm locked with pain. Still, there was no breath. His chest heaved uselessly. He staggered backward. One foot danced out over nothingness, and then he fell back down the stairs in two great bone-snapping barrel rolls, legs flying over his head, arms waving, blue bathrobe sailing and flapping. He landed in a heap at the bottom, and Christine pounced upon him, struck him, reversed, struck him again, snapped off the heavy newel post at the foot of the stairs like a twig, reversed, struck him again. From beneath the floor came the increasing mutter of supports splintering and bowing. Christine paused in the middle of the room for a moment, as if listening. Two of her tires were flat. A third had come half off the wheel. The left side of the car was punched inward, scraped clean of paint in great, bald patches. Suddenly her gear shift dropped into reverse. Her engine screamed, and she rocketed back across the room and out of the ragged hole in the side of Will Darnell's house, her rear end dropping down several inches and into the snow. The tires spun, found some purchase, and pulled her out. She backed limpingly toward the road, her engine chopping and missing now, blue smoke hazing the air around her, oil dripping and spraying. At the road, she turned back toward Libertyville. The gear shift lever dropped into drive, but at first the damaged transmission wouldn't catch. When it did, she rolled slowly away from the house. Behind her, from Will's house, a broad bar of light shone out onto the churned-up snow, in a shape that was not at all like the neat rectangle of light thrown by a window. The shape of the light on the snow was senseless and strange. She moved slowly, lurching from side to side on her flats like a very old drunk making her way up an alley. Snow fell thickly, driven into slanting lines by the wind. One of her headlights, shattered in her last destructive trampling charge, flickered and came on. One of the tires began to reinflate, then the other. The clouds of stinking oil smoke began to diminish. The engine's chopping, uncertain note smoothed out. The missing hood began to reappear from the windshield end down, looking weirdly like a scarf or cardigan being knitted by invisible needles. The raw metal drew itself out of nothing, gleamed steel gray, and then darkened to red, as if filling with blood. The cracks in the windshield began to run in reverse, leaving unflawed smoothness behind themselves. The other headlights came on, one after the other. Now she moved with swift surety through the stormy night, behind the cutting edge of her confident brights. Her odometer spun smoothly backward. 45 minutes later, she sat in the darkness at the late Will Darnell's do-it-yourself garage, install 20. The wind howled and moaned in the ranks of the wrecks out back, rusting hulks that perhaps held their own ghosts and their own baleful memories as powdery snow skirled across the ripped and tattered seats, their balding floor carpets. Her engine ticked slowly, cooling. Part 3. Christine. Teenage Death Songs. Chapter 43 Lee Comes to Visit. About 15 minutes before Lee was due, I got my crutches under me and worked my way to the chair closest to the door so she'd be sure to hear me when I hollered for her to come in. Then I picked up my copy of Esquire again and turned back to an article titled The Next Vietnam, which was part of a school assignment. I still had no success reading it. I was nervous and scared, and part of it, a lot of it, I guess, was simple eagerness. I wanted to see her again. The house was empty. Not too long after Lee called that stormy Christmas Eve afternoon, I got my dad aside and asked him if he could maybe take Mom and Elaine someplace the afternoon of the 26th.
Why not?
He agreed, amiably enough. Thanks, Dad.
Sure, but you owe me one, Dennis.
Dad? He winked solemnly.
I'll scratch your back if you'll scratch mine.
Nice guy, I said.
A real prince, he agreed.
My dad, who was no slouch, asked me if it had to do with Arnie.
She's his girl, isn't she?
Well, I said, not sure just what the situation was, and uncomfortable for reasons of my own. She has been. I don't know about now.
Problems?
I didn't do such a hot job being his eyes, did I?
It's hard to see from a hospital bed, Dennis. I'll make sure your mother and Ellie are out Tuesday afternoon. Just be careful, okay?
Since then, I've pondered exactly what he might have meant by that. He surely couldn't have been worried about me trying to jump Lee's bones, with one upper leg still in plaster and a half cast on my back. I think maybe he was just afraid that something had gotten terribly out of whack, with my old childhood friend suddenly a stranger, and a stranger who was out on bail at that. I sure thought something was out of whack, and it scared the piss out of me. The Keystone doesn't publish on Christmas, but all three Pittsburgh Network TV affiliates and both the independent channels had the story of what had happened to Will Darnell, along with bizarre and frightening pictures of his house. The side facing the road had been demolished. It was the only word which fit. That side of the house looked as if some mad Nazi had driven a panzer tank through it. The story had been headlined this morning, "Foul Play Suspected in Bizarre Death of Suspected Crime Figure." That was bad enough, even without another picture of Will Darnell's house with that big hole punched in the side. But you had to check page 3 to get the rest of it. The other item was smaller because Will Darnell had been a suspected crime figure, and Don Vandenberg had only been a dipshit dropout gas jockey. "Service station attendant killed in Christmas Eve hit and run," this headline read. A single column followed. The story ended with the Libertyville chief of police theorizing that the driver had probably been drunk or stoned. Neither he nor the Keystone made any attempt to connect the deaths, which had been separated by almost 10 miles on the night of a screaming blizzard which had stopped all traffic in Ohio and western Pennsylvania. But I could make connections. I didn't want to, but I couldn't help it. And hadn't my father been looking at me strangely several times during the morning? Yes, once or twice it had seemed he would say something. I had no idea what I would say if he did. Will Darnell's death, bizarre as it had been, was nowhere nearly as bizarre as my suspicions. Then he had closed his mouth without speaking. That, to be upfront about it, was something of a relief. The doorbell chimed at 2:02. "Come on in," I yelled, getting up on my crutches again anyway. The door opened, and Lee poked her head in.
"Dennis?"
"Yeah, come on in."
She did, looking very pretty in a bright red ski parka and dark blue pants. She pushed the parka's fur-edged hood back.
"Sit down," she said, unzipping her parka. "Go on, right now, that's an order. You look like a big dumb stork on those things."
"Keep it up," I said, sitting down again with an ungainly plop. "When you're cast in plaster, it's never like in the movies. You never sit down like Cary Grant, getting ready to have cocktails at the Ritz with Ingrid Bergman. It all happens at once, and if the cushion you land on doesn't give out a big loud raspberry, as if your sudden descent had scared you into cutting the cheese, you count yourself ahead of the game." This time I got lucky. I'm such a sucker for flattery that I make myself sick.
"How are you, Dennis?"
"Mending," I said. "How about you?"
"I've been better," she said, in a low voice, and bit at her lower lip. This can sometimes be a seductive gesture on a girl's part, but it wasn't this time. "Hang up your coat and sit down yourself."
"Okay."
Her eyes touched mine, and looking at them was a little much. I looked someplace else, thinking about Arnie. She hung her coat up and came back into the living room slowly.
Your folks?
I got my father to take everyone out, I said. I thought maybe... I shrugged. We ought to talk just between ourselves. She stood by the sofa, looking at me across the room. I was struck again by the simplicity of her good looks. Her lovely girl's figure, outlined in dark blue pants and a sweater of a lighter, powdery blue, an outfit that made me think about skiing. Her hair was tied in a loose pigtail and lay over her left shoulder. Her eyes were the color of her sweater, maybe a little darker. A corn-fed American beauty, you would have said, except for the high cheekbones, which seemed a little arrogant, bespeaking some older, more exotic heritage. Maybe some 15 or 20 generations back there was a Viking in the woodpile. Or maybe that isn't what I was thinking at all. She saw me looking at her too long and blushed. I looked away.
Dennis, are you worried about him?
Worried? Scared might be a better word.
What do you know about that car? What has he told you?
Not much, I said. Look, would you like something to drink? There's some stuff in the fridge. I felt for my crutches.
Sit still, she said. I would like something, but I'll get it. What about you?
I'll take a ginger ale if there's one left. She went into the kitchen, and I watched her shadow on the wall, moving lightly like a dancer. There was a momentary added weight in my stomach, almost like a sickness. There's a name for that sort of sickness. I think it's called falling in love with your best friend's girl.
You've got an automatic ice maker, her voice floated back. We've got one too, I love it.
Sometimes it goes crazy and sprays ice cubes all over the floor, I said. It's like Jimmy Cagney, White Heat. Take that, you dirty rats. It drives my mother crazy. I was babbling. She laughed. Ice cubes clinked in glasses. Shortly she came back with 2 glasses of ice and 2 cans of Canada Dry. Thanks, I said, taking mine.
No, thank you, she said.
And now her blue eyes were dark and sober.
Thanks for being around. If I had to deal with this alone, I think I'd... I don't know.
Come on, I said. It's not that bad.
Isn't it? Do you know about Darnell?
I nodded.
And that other one, Don Vandenberg?
So she had made the connection, too. I nodded again. I saw it. Lee, what is it about Christine that bothers you? For a long time, I didn't know if she was going to answer. If she would be able to answer. I could see her struggling with it, looking down at her glass held in both hands. At last, in a very low voice, she said,
I think she tried to kill me.
I don't know what I had expected, but it wasn't that. What do you mean? She talked, first hesitantly, then more rapidly, until it was pouring out of her. It is a story you've already heard, so I won't repeat it here. Suffice it to say that I tried to tell it pretty much as she told it to me. She hadn't been kidding about being scared. It was the pallor of her face, the little hitches and gulps of her voice, the way her hands constantly caressed her upper arms as if she was too cold in spite of the sweater. And the more she talked, the more scared I got. She finished by telling me how, as consciousness dwindled, the dashboard lights had seemed to turn into watching eyes. She laughed nervously at this last, as if trying to take the curse off an obvious absurdity. But I didn't laugh back. I was remembering George LeBay's dry voice as we sat in cheap patio chairs in front of the Rainbow Motel, his voice telling me the story of Roland, Veronica, and Rita. I was remembering those things, and my mind was making unspeakable connections. Lights were going on. I didn't like what they were revealing. My heart started to thud heavily in my chest, and I couldn't have joined her laughter if my life had depended on it. She told me about the ultimatum she had given him, her or the car. She told me about Arnie's furious reaction. That had been the last time she went out with him.
Then he got arrested, she said, and I started to think about what had happened to Buddy Repperton and those other boys, and Moochie Welch.
And now Vandenberg and Darnell.
Yes, but that's not all.
She drank from her glass of ginger ale and then poured in more. The edge of the can chattered briefly against the rim of the glass.
Christmas Eve, when I called you? My mom and dad went out for drinks at my dad's boss's house, and I started to get nervous. I was thinking about... Oh, I don't know what I was thinking about.
I think you do.
She put a hand to her forehead and rubbed it as if she was getting a headache.
I suppose I do. I was thinking about that car being out. Her being out and getting them. But if she was out on Christmas Eve, I guess she had plenty to keep her busy without bothering my parents.
She slammed her glass down, making me jump.
And why do I keep talking about that car as if it was a person?
She cried out. Tears had begun to spill down her cheeks.
Why do I keep doing that?
On that night, I saw all too clearly what comforting her could lead to. Arnie was between us, and part of myself was too. I had known him for a long time. A long, good time. But that was then. This was now. I got my crutches under me, thumped my way across to the couch, and plopped down beside her. The cushions sighed. It wasn't a raspberry, but it was close. My mother keeps a box of Kleenex in the drawer of the little end table. I pulled one out, looked at her, and pulled out a whole handful. I gave them to her, and she thanked me. Then, not liking myself much, I put an arm around her and held her. She stiffened for a moment, and then let me draw her against my shoulder. She was trembling. We just sat that way, both of us afraid of even the slightest movement, I think. Afraid we might explode. Or something. Across the room, the clock ticked importantly on the mantelpiece. Bright winter light fell through the bow windows that give a three-way view of the street. The storm had blown itself out by noon on Christmas Day, and now the hard and cloudless blue sky seemed to deny that there ever was such a thing as snow. But the dune-like drifts rolling across lawns all up and down the street like the backs of great buried beasts confirmed it. "The smell," I said at last. "How sure are you about that?"
"It was there," she said,
drawing away from me and sitting up straight. I collected my arm again with a mixed sensation of disappointment and relief.
"It really was there. A rotten, horrible smell."
She looked at me.
"Why? Have you smelled it too?"
I shook my head. I never had. Not really.
"What do you know about that car, then?" she asked. "You know something. I can see it on your face."
It was my turn to think long and hard. And oddly, what came into my mind was an image of nuclear fission from some science textbook, a cartoon. You don't expect to see cartoons in science books, but as someone once said to me, there are many devious twists and turns along the path of public education. In point of fact, that someone had been Arnie himself. The cartoon showed two hot rod atoms speeding toward each other and then slamming together. Presto, instead of a lot of wreckage and atom ambulances to take away the dead and wounded neutrons, critical mass, chain reaction, and one hell of a big bang. Then I decided the memory of that cartoon really wasn't odd at all. Lee had certain information I hadn't had before. The reverse was also true. In both cases, a lot of it was guesswork, a lot of it was subjective feeling and circumstance, but enough of it was hard information to be really scary. I wondered briefly what the police would do if they knew what we did. I could guess. Nothing. Could you bring a ghost to trial? Or a car?
Dennis?
I'm thinking, I said. Can't you smell the wood burning?
What do you know?
She asked again. Collision. Critical mass. Chain reaction. Kaboom. The thing was, I was thinking, if we put our information together, we would have to do something. Or tell someone. Take some action. I remembered my dream. The car sitting there in LeBay's garage, the motor revving up and then falling off, revving up again, the headlights coming on, the shriek of tires. I took her hand in both of mine. "Okay," I said. "Listen, Arnie, he bought Christine from a guy who is dead now, a guy named Roland D. LeBay. We saw her on his lawn one day when we were coming home from work, and..."
"You're doing it too,"
she said softly.
"What?"
"Calling it she."
I nodded, not letting go of her hands. Yeah, I know, it's hard to stop. The thing is, Arnie wanted her, or it, or whatever that car is, from the first time he laid eyes on her. And I think now, I didn't then, but I do now, that LeBay wanted Arnie to have her just as badly. That he would have given her to him if it had come to that. It's like Arnie saw Christine and knew, and then LeBay saw Arnie and knew the same thing. Lee pulled her hands free of mine and began to rub her elbows restlessly again.
Arnie said he paid.
He paid, all right. And he's still paying. That is, if Arnie's left at all.
I don't understand what you mean.
I'll show you, I said. In a few minutes. First, let me give you the background.
All right.
LeBay had a wife and daughter. This was back in the 50s. His daughter died beside the road. She choked to death. On a hamburger. Lee's face grew white, then whiter. For a moment, she seemed as milky and translucent as clouded glass. Lee, I said sharply, you all right?
Yes,
she said with chilling placidity. Her color didn't improve. Her mouth moved in a horrid grimace that was perhaps intended to be a reassuring smile.
I'm fine, she stood up. Where's the bathroom, please?
There's one at the end of the hall, I said. Lee, you look awful.
I'm going to vomit,
she said, in that same placid voice, and walked away. She moved jerkily now, like a puppet, all the dancer's grace I had seen in her shadow now gone. She walked out of the room slowly, but when she was out of sight, the rhythm of her stride picked up. I heard the bathroom door thrown open, and then the sounds. I leaned back against the sofa and put my hands over my eyes. When she came back, she was still pale, but had regained a touch of her color. She had washed her face, and there were still a few drops of water on her cheeks.
I'm sorry, I said. It's all right. It just startled me.
She smiled wanly.
I guess that's an understatement.
She caught my eyes with hers.
Just tell me one thing, Dennis. What you said, is it true? Really true?
Yeah, I said. It's true. And there's more, but do you really want to hear any more?
No, she said. But tell me anyway.
We could drop it, I said, not really believing it. Her grave, distressed eyes held mine.
It might be safer if we didn't, she said.
His wife committed suicide shortly after their daughter died.
The car
was involved.
How?
Lee,
how?
So I told her. Not just about the little girl and her mother, but about LeBay himself, as his brother George had told me. His bottomless reservoir of anger. The kids who had made fun of his clothes and his bowl haircut. His escape into the army, where everyone's clothes and haircuts were the same. The motor pool, the constant railing at the shitters, particularly those shitters who brought him their big expensive cars to be fixed at government expense. The Second World War, the brother Drew killed in France, the old Chevrolet, the old Hudson Hornet, and through it all, a steady and unchanging backbeat, the anger.
That word,
Lee murmured.
What word? Shitters.
She had to force herself to say it, her nose wrinkling in rueful and almost unconscious distaste.
He uses it. Arnie.
I know. We looked at each other, and her hands found mine again. You cold, I said. Another bright remark from that font of wisdom, Dennis Gilder. I got a million of them.
Yes. I feel like I'll never be warm again.
I wanted to put my arms around her, and didn't. I was afraid to. Arnie was still too much mixed up in things. The most awful thing, and it was awful, was how it seemed more and more that he was dead. Dead, or under some weird enchantment.
Did his brother say anything else?
Nothing that seems to fit. But a memory rose like a bubble in still water and popped. He was obsessed, and he was angry, but he was not a monster, George LeBay had told me. At least, I don't think he was. It had seemed that, lost in the past as he had been about to say something more, and then had realized where he was, and that he was talking to a stranger. What had he been about to say? All at once, I had a really monstrous idea. I pushed it away. It went, but it was hard work, pushing that idea, like pushing a piano, and I could still see its outlines in the shadows. I became aware that Lee was looking at me very closely, and I wondered how much of what I had been thinking showed on my face.
"Did you take Mr. LeBay's address?" she asked.
"No." I thought for a moment, and then remembered the funeral, which now seemed impossibly far back in time. "But I imagine the Libertyville American Legion post has it. They buried LeBay and contacted the brother. Why?"
Lee only shook her head and went to the window, where she stood looking out into the blinding day.
"Shank of the year," I thought randomly. She turned back to me, and I was struck by her beauty again, calm and undemanding, except for those high, arrogant cheekbones, the sort of cheekbones you might expect to see on a lady probably carrying a knife in her belt.
"You said you'd show me something," she said. "What was it?"
I nodded. There was no way to stop now. The chain reaction had started. There was no way to shut it down. "Go upstairs," I said. "My room is the second door on the left. Look in the third drawer of my dresser. You'll have to dig under some of my undies, but they won't bite."
She smiled. Only a little, but even a little was an improvement. "And what am I going to find, a baggie of dope?"
"I gave that up last year," I said, smiling back.